Then, since we're holding you, you will perish with us? Possibly. Don't you want to live? Passionately. He saw the snap of a spark in Mr. Thompson's eyes and smiled. I'll tell you more. I know that I want to live much more intensely than you do. I know that that's what you're counting on. I know that you, in fact, do not want to live at all. I want it, and because I want it so much, I will accept no substitute. Mr. Thompson jumped to his feet. That's not true, he cried. My not wanting to live, it's not true. Why do you talk like that? He stood, his limbs drawn faintly together, as if against a sudden chill. Why do you say such things? I don't know what you mean. He backed a few steps away. And it's not true that I'm a gunman. I'm not. I don't intend to harm you. I never intended to harm anybody. I want people to like me. I want to be your friend. I want to be your friend, he cried to the space at large. Galt's eyes were watching him without expression, giving him no clue to what they were seeing, except that they were seeing it. Mr. Thompson jerked suddenly into bustling, unnecessary motion as if he were in a hurry. I've got to run along, he said. I have so many appointments. We'll talk about it some more. Think it over. Take your time. I'm not trying to high-pressure you. Just relax, take it easy, and make yourself at home. Ask for anything you like. Food, drinks, cigarettes, the best of anything. He waved his hand at Galt's garments. I'm going to order the most expensive tailor in the city to make some decent clothes for you. I want you to get used to the best. I want you to be comfortable and... Say, he asked a little too casually, have you got any family, any relatives you'd like to see?
No.
Any friends?
No.
Have you got a sweetheart?
No.
It's just that I wouldn't want you to get lonesome. We can't let you have visitors, any visitor you name, if there's anyone you care for.
There isn't.
Mr. Thompson paused at the door, turned to look at Galt for a moment, and shook his head. I can't figure you out, he said. I just can't figure you out. Galt smiled, shrugged, and answered,
Who is John Galt?
A whirling mesh of sleet hung over the entrance of the Wayne Falkland Hotel, and the armed guards looked oddly, desolately helpless in the circle of light. They stood hunched, heads down, hugging their guns for warmth. As if were they to release all the spitting violence of their bullets at the storm, it would not bring comfort to their bodies. From across the street, Chick Morrison, the morale conditioner, on his way to a conference on the 59th floor, noted that the rare lethargic passers-by were not taking the trouble to glance at the guards, as they did not take the trouble to glance at the soggy headlines of a pile of unsold newspapers on the stand of a ragged, shivering vendor. John Galt promises prosperity. Chick Morrison shook his head uneasily. 6 days of front-page stories about the united efforts of the country's leaders working with John Galt to shape new policies had brought no results. People were moving, he observed, as if they did not care to see anything around them. No one took any notice of his existence, except a ragged old woman who stretched out her hand to him silently as he approached the lights of the entrance. He hurried past, and only drops of sleet fell on the gnarled, naked palm. It was his memory of the streets that gave a jagged sound to Chick Morrison's voice when he spoke to a circle of faces in Mr. Thompson's room on the 59th floor. The look of the faces matched the sound of his voice. It doesn't seem to work, he said, pointing to a pile of reports from his public pulse takers. All the press releases about our collaborating with John Galt don't seem to make any difference. People don't care. They don't believe a word of it. Some of them say that he'll never collaborate with us. Most of them don't even believe that we've got him. I don't know what's happened to people. They don't believe anything anymore. He sighed. 3 factories went out of business in Cleveland day before yesterday. 5 factories closed in Chicago yesterday. In San Francisco?
I know,
snapped Mr. Thompson, tightening the muffler around his throat. The building's furnace had gone out of order. There's no choice about it. He's got to give in and take over. He's got to. Wesley Mooch glanced at the ceiling. Don't ask me to talk to him again, he said, and shuddered. I've tried. One can't talk to that man.
I can't, Mr. Thompson,
cried Chick Morrison in answer to the stop of Mr. Thompson's roving glance. I'll resign if you want me to. I can't talk to him again. Don't make me.
Nobody can talk to him, said Dr. Floyd Ferris. It's a waste of time. He doesn't hear a word you say.
Fred Kinnan chuckled.
You mean he hears too much, don't you?
And what's worse, he answers it.
Well, why don't you try it again? Snapped Mooch. You seem to have enjoyed it. Why don't you try to persuade him?
I know better, said Kinnan.
Don't fool yourself, brother. Nobody's going to persuade him. I won't try it twice.
Enjoyed it? He added with a look of astonishment. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I did.
What's the matter with you? Are you falling for him? Are you letting him win you over?
Me?
Kinnan chuckled mirthlessly.
What use would he have for me? I'll be the first one to go down the drain when he wins.
It's only... He glanced wistfully up at the ceiling.
It's only that he's a man who talks straight.
He won't win, snapped Mr. Thompson. It's out of the question. There was a long pause. There are hunger riots in West Virginia, said Wesley Mooch, and the farmers in Texas have...
Mr. Thompson, said Chick Morrison desperately.
Maybe we could let the public see him at a mass rally, or maybe on TV. Just see him, just so they'd believe that we've really got him. It would give people hope for a while. It would give us a little time.
Too dangerous, snapped Dr. Ferris. Don't let him come anywhere near the public. There's no limit to what he'll permit himself to do.
He's got to give in, said Mr. Thompson stubbornly. He's got to join us. One of you must...
No,
screamed Eugene Lawson.
Not me. I don't want to see him at all. Not once. I don't want to have to believe it.
What? Asked James Taggart. His voice had a note of dangerously reckless mockery. Lawson did not answer.
What are you scared of?
The contempt in Taggart's voice sounded abnormally stressed, as if the sight of someone's greater fear were tempting him to defy his own.
What is it you're scared to believe, Gene?
I won't believe it. I won't.
Lawson's voice was half snarl, half whimper.
You can't make me lose my faith in humanity. You shouldn't permit such a man to be possible. A ruthless egoist who...
You're a fine bunch of intellectuals, you are, said Mr. Thompson scornfully. I thought you could talk to him in his own lingo, but he scared the lot of you.
Ideas? Where are your ideas now? Do something. Make him join us. Win him over.
Trouble is, he doesn't want anything, said Mooch. What can we offer a man who doesn't want anything?
You mean, said Kinnan, what can we offer a man who wants to live?
Shut up, screamed James Taggart. Why did you say that? What made you say it?
What made you scream? Asked Kinnan.
Keep quiet, all of you, ordered Mr. Thompson.
You're fine at fighting one another, but when it comes to fighting a real man...
So he's got you too,
yelled Lawson.
Oh, pipe down,
said Mr. Thompson wearily. He's the toughest bastard I've ever been up against. You wouldn't understand that. He's as hard as they come. The faintest tinge of admiration crept into his voice. As hard as they come. The faintest tinge of admiration crept into his voice. As hard as they come.
There are ways to persuade tough bastards, drawled Dr. Ferris casually. As I've explained to you.
No, cried Mr. Thompson. No, shut up. I won't listen to you. I won't hear of it. His hands moved frantically, as if struggling to dispel something he would not name. I told him that that's not true, that we're not, that I'm not a... He shook his head violently, as if his own words were some unprecedented form of danger. No. Look, boys, what I mean is, we've got to be practical and cautious, damn cautious. We've got to handle it peacefully. We can't afford to antagonize him or harm him. We don't dare take any chances on anything happening to him, because if he goes, we go. He's our last hope. Make no mistake about it. If he goes, we perish. You all know it. His eyes swept over the faces around him. They knew it. The sleet of the following morning fell down on front-page stories announcing that a constructive, harmonious conference between John Galt and the country's leaders on the previous afternoon had produced the John Galt Plan, soon to be announced.
The snowflakes of the evening fell down upon the furniture of an apartment house whose front wall had collapsed, and upon a crowd of men waiting silently at the closed cashier's window of a plant whose owner had vanished. The farmers of South Dakota, Wesley Mooch reported to Mr. Thompson next morning, are marching on the state capitol, burning every government building on their way, and every home worth more than $10,000. California's blown to pieces, he reported in the evening. There's a civil war going on there, if that's what it is, which nobody seems to be sure of. They've declared that they're seceding from the Union, but nobody knows who's now in power. There's armed fighting all over the state between a People's Party led by Ma Chalmers and her soybean cult of Orient admirers, and something called Back to God, led by some former oil field owners. Miss Taggart, moaned Mr. Thompson when she entered his hotel room next morning in answer to his summons. What are we going to do? He wondered why he had once felt that she possessed some reassuring kind of energy. He was looking at a blank face that seemed composed, but the composure became disquieting when one noticed that it lasted for minute after minute with no change of expression, no sign of feeling. Her face had the same look as all the others, he thought, except for something in the set of the mouth that suggested endurance. I trust you, Miss Taggart. You've got more brains than all my boys, he pleaded. You've done more for the country than any of them. It's you who found him for us. What are we to do? With everything falling to pieces, he's the only one who can lead us out of this mess. But he won't. He refuses. He simply refuses to lead. I've never seen anything like it. A man who has no desire to command. We beg him to give orders, and he answers that he wants to obey them. It's preposterous. It is. What do you make of it? Can you figure him out? He's an arrogant egoist, she said. He's an ambitious adventurer. He's a man of unlimited audacity who's playing for the biggest stakes in the world. It was easy, she thought. It would have been difficult in that distant time when she had regarded language as a tool of honor, always to be used as if one were under oath. An oath of allegiance to reality and to respect for human beings. Now, it was only a matter of making sounds, inarticulate sounds addressed to inanimate objects, unrelated to such concepts as reality, human, or honor. It had been easy that first morning to report to Mr. Thompson how she had traced John Galt to his home. It had been easy to watch Mr. Thompson's gulping smiles and his repeated cries of, "That's my girl!" uttered with glances of triumph at his assistance, the triumph of a man whose judgment in trusting her had been vindicated. It had been easy to express an angry hatred for Galt. I used to agree with his ideas, but I won't let him destroy my railroad. And to hear Mr. Thompson say, "Don't you worry, Miss Taggart. We'll protect you from him." It had been easy to assume a look of cold shrewdness and to remind Mr. Thompson of the $500,000 reward, her voice clear and cutting, like the sound of an adding machine punching out the sum of a bill. She had seen an instant's pause in Mr. Thompson's facial muscles, then a brighter, broader smile, like a silent speech declaring that he had not expected it, but was delighted to know what made her tick, and that it was the kind of ticking he understood. "Of course, Miss Taggart, certainly. That reward is yours, all yours. The check will be sent to you in full." It had been easy, because she had felt as if she were in some dreary non-world, where her words and actions were not facts any longer, not reflections of reality, but only distorted postures in one of those sideshow mirrors that project deformity for the perception of beings whose consciousness is not to be treated as consciousness. Thin, single, and hot, like the burning pressure of a wire within her, like a needle selecting her course, was her only concern, the thought of his safety. The rest was a blur of shapeless disillusion, half acid, half fog. But this, she thought with a shudder, was the state in which they lived. All those people, whom she had never understood, this was the state they desired. This rubber reality, this task of pretending, distorting, deceiving, with the credulous stare of some Mr. Thompson's panic-bleary eyes, as one's only purpose and reward. Those who desired this state, she wondered, did they want to live? "The biggest stakes in the world, Miss Taggart?" Mr. Thompson was asking her anxiously. "What is it? What does he want? Reality? This earth?" "I don't know quite what you mean, but
Look, Miss Taggart, if you think you can understand him, would you? Would you try to speak to him once more?
She felt as if she heard her own voice many light years away, crying that she would give her life to see him. But in this room, she heard the voice of a meaningless stranger saying coldly, "No, Mr. Thompson, I wouldn't. I hope I'll never have to see him again. I know that you can't stand him, and I can't say I blame you. But couldn't you just try to—" "I tried to reason with him the night I found him. I heard nothing but insults in return. I think he resents me more than he'd resent anyone else. He won't forgive me the fact that it was I who trapped him. I'd be the last person to whom he would surrender."
"Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Do you think he will ever surrender?"
The needle within her wavered for a moment, burning its oscillating way between two courses. Should she say that he would not, and see them kill him? Should she say that he would, and see them hold on to their power till they destroyed the world? "He will," she said firmly. "He'll give in if you treat him right. He's too ambitious to refuse power. Don't let him escape, but don't threaten him or harm him. Fear won't work. He's impervious to fear."
"But what if—" "I mean, with the way things are collapsing.
What if he holds out too long?" "He won't. He's too practical for that. By the way, are you letting him hear any news about the state of the country?"
"Why, no."
"I would suggest that you let him have copies of your confidential reports. He'll see that it won't be long now."
"That's a good idea.
A very good idea. You know, Miss Taggart," he said suddenly, with the sound of some desperate clinging in his voice,
"I feel better whenever I talk to you. It's because I trust you. I don't trust anybody around me but you. You're different. You're solid."
She was looking unflinchingly straight at him. "Thank you, Mr. Thompson," she said. It had been easy, she thought, until she walked out into the street and noticed that under her coat, her blouse was sticking damply to her shoulder blades. Were she able to feel, she thought, as she walked through the concourse of the terminal, she would know that the heavy indifference she now felt for her railroad was hatred. She could not get rid of the feeling that she was running nothing but freight trains. The passengers to her were not living or human. It seemed senseless to waste such enormous effort on preventing catastrophes, on protecting the safety of trains, carrying nothing but inanimate objects. She looked at the faces in the terminal. If he were to die, she thought, to be murdered by the rulers of their system, that these might continue to eat, sleep, and travel, would she work to provide them with trains? If she were to scream for their help, would one of them rise to his defense? Did they want him to live, they who had hurt him? The check for $500,000 was delivered to her office that afternoon. It was delivered with a bouquet of flowers from Mr. Thompson. She looked at the check and let it flutter down to her desk. It meant nothing, and made her feel nothing, not even a suggestion of guilt. It was a scrap of paper, of no greater significance than the ones in the office wastebasket. Whether it could buy a diamond necklace, or the city dump, or the last of her food, made no difference. It would never be spent. It was not a token of value, and nothing it purchased could be of value. But this, she thought, this inanimate indifference was the permanent state of the people around her, of men who had no purpose and no passion. This was the state of a non-valuing soul. Those who chose it, she wondered. Did they want to live? The lights were out of order in the hall of the apartment house when she came home that evening, numb with exhaustion, and she did not notice the envelope at her feet until she switched on the light in her foyer. It was a blank, sealed envelope that had been slipped under her door. She picked it up, and then within a moment she was laughing soundlessly, half kneeling, half sitting on the floor, not to move off that spot, not to do anything but stare at the note, written by a hand she knew, the hand that had written its last message on the calendar above the city. The note said, "Dagny, sit tight, watch them. When he'll need our help, call me at OR65693. The newspapers of the following morning admonished the public not to believe the rumors that there was any trouble in the southern states. The confidential report sent to Mr. Thompson stated that armed fighting had broken out between Georgia and Alabama for the possession of a factory manufacturing electrical equipment, a factory cut off by the fighting and by blasted railroad tracks from any source of raw materials. "Have you read the confidential reports I sent you?" moaned Mr. Thompson that evening, facing Galt once more. He was accompanied by James Taggart, who had volunteered to meet the prisoner for the first time. Galt sat on a straight-backed chair, his legs crossed, smoking a cigarette. He seemed erect and relaxed together. They could not decipher the expression on his face, except that it showed no sign of apprehension. "I have," he answered.
"There's not much time left," said Mr. Thompson. "There isn't." "Are you going to let such things go on?"
"Are you?"
"How can you be so sure you're right?" cried James Taggart.
His voice was not loud, but it had the intensity of a cry. "How can you take it upon yourself at a terrible time like this to stick to your own ideas at the risk of destroying the whole world?"
"Whose ideas should I consider safer to follow?"
"How can you be sure you're right? How can you know? Nobody can be sure of his knowledge. Nobody. You're no better than anyone else."
"Then why do you want me?"
"How can you gamble with other people's lives? How can you permit yourself such a selfish luxury as to hold out when people need you?"
"You mean, when they need my ideas?"
"Nobody is fully right or wrong. There isn't any black or white. You don't have a monopoly on truth."
There was something wrong in Taggart's manner, thought Mr. Thompson, frowning. Some odd, too personal resentment. As if it were not a political issue that he had come here to solve.
"If you had any sense of responsibility," Taggart was saying, "you wouldn't dare take such a chance on nothing but your own judgment. You would join us and consider some ideas other than your own and admit that we might be right, too. You would help us with our plans. You would..."
Taggart went on, speaking with feverish insistence. But Mr. Thompson could not tell whether Galt was listening. Galt had risen and was pacing the room, not in a manner of restlessness, but in the casual manner of a man enjoying the motion of his own body. Mr. Thompson noted the lightness of the steps, the straight spine, the flat stomach, the relaxed shoulders. Galt walked as if he were both unconscious of his body and tremendously conscious of his pride in it. Mr. Thompson glanced at James Taggart, at the sloppy posture of a tall figure slumped in ungainly self-distortion, and caught him watching Galt's movements with such hatred that Mr. Thompson sat up, fearing it would become audible in the room. But Galt was not looking at Taggart.
"Your conscience," Taggart was saying. "I came here to appeal to your conscience. How can you value your mind above thousands of human lives? People are perishing and..." "Oh, for Christ's sake," he snapped. "Stop pacing."
Galt stopped.
"Is this an order?"
"No, no,"
said Mr. Thompson hastily. "It's not an order. We don't want to give you orders. Take it easy, Jim." Galt resumed his pacing.
"The world is collapsing," said Taggart, his eyes following Galt irresistibly. "People are perishing, and it's you who could save them. Does it matter who's right or wrong? You should join us. Even if you think we're wrong, you should sacrifice your mind to save them."
"By what means will I then save them?"
"Who do you think you are?" cried Taggart.
Galt stopped.
"You know it."
"You're an egoist."
"I am."
"Do you realize what sort of egoist you are?"
"Do you?"
asked Galt, looking straight at him. It was the slow withdrawal of Taggart's body into the depth of his armchair, while his eyes were holding Galt's, that made Mr. Thompson unaccountably afraid of the next moment.
"Say,"
Mr. Thompson interrupted in a brightly casual voice,
"what sort of cigarette are you smoking?"
Galt turned to him and smiled.
"I don't know."
"Where did you get it?"
"One of your guards brought me a package of them. He said some man asked him to give it to me as a present." "Don't worry," he added. "Your boys have put it through every kind of test. There were no hidden messages. It was just a present from an anonymous admirer."
The cigarette between Galt's fingers bore the sign of the dollar. James Taggart was no good at the job of persuasion, Mr. Thompson concluded, but Chick Morrison, whom he brought the next day, did no better.
I'll just throw myself on your mercy, Mr. Galt," said Chick Morrison with a frantic smile.
"You're right. I'll concede that you're right, and all I can appeal to is your pity.
Deep down in my heart, I can't believe that you're a total egoist who feels no pity for the people. He pointed to a pile of papers he had spread on a table. Here's a plea signed by 10,000 school children, begging you to join us and save them. Here's a plea from a home for the crippled. Here's a petition sent by the ministers of 200 different faiths. Here's an appeal from the mothers of the country. Read them.
Is this an order?
No, cried Mr. Thompson. It's not an order.
Galt remained motionless, not extending his hand for the papers.
These are just plain, ordinary people, Mr. Galt, said Chick Morrison, in a tone intended to project their abject humility. They can't tell you what to do. They wouldn't know. They're merely begging you. They may be weak, helpless, blind, ignorant. But you, who are so intelligent and strong, can't you take pity on them? Can't you help them?
By dropping my intelligence and following their blindness?
They may be wrong, but they don't know any better.
But I, who do, should obey them.
I can't argue, Mr. Galt. I'm just begging for your pity. They're suffering. I'm begging you to pity those who suffer. Mr. Galt, he asked, noticing that Galt was looking off at the distance beyond the window, and that his eyes were suddenly implacable. What's the matter? What are you thinking of?
Hank Reardon.
Why?
Did they feel any pity for Hank Reardon?
Oh, but that's different. He...
Shut up, said Galt evenly.
I only...
Shut up, snapped Mr. Thompson.
Don't mind him, Mr. Galt. He hasn't slept for 2 nights. He's scared out of his wits.
Dr. Floyd Ferris next day did not seem to be scared. But it was worse, thought Mr. Thompson. He observed that Galt remained silent and would not answer Ferris at all. It's the question of moral responsibility that you might not have studied sufficiently, Mr. Galt. Dr. Ferris was drawling in too airy, too forced a tone of casual informality. You seem to have talked on the radio about nothing but sins of commission, but there are also the sins of omission to consider. To fail to save a life is as immoral as to murder. The consequences are the same, and since we must judge actions by their consequences, the moral responsibility is the same. For instance, in view of the desperate shortage of food, it has been suggested that it might become necessary to issue a directive ordering that every third one of all children under the age of 10 and of all adults over the age of 60 be put to death to secure the survival of the rest. You wouldn't want this to happen, would you? You can prevent it. One word from you would prevent it. If you refuse and all those people are executed, it will be your fault and your moral responsibility.
You're crazy, screamed Mr. Thompson, recovering from shock and leaping to his feet. Nobody's ever suggested any such thing. Nobody's ever considered it. Please, Mr. Galt, don't believe him. He doesn't mean it.
Oh, yes, he does, said Galt. Tell the bastard to look at me, then look in the mirror, then ask himself whether I would ever think that my moral stature is at the mercy of his actions.
Get out of here, cried Mr. Thompson, yanking Ferris to his feet. Get out. Don't let me hear another squeak out of you.
He flung the door open and pushed Ferris at the startled face of a guard outside. Turning to Galt, he spread his arms and let them drop with a gesture of drained helplessness. Galt's face was expressionless.
Look, said Mr. Thompson pleadingly,
isn't there anybody who can talk to you?
There's nothing to talk about.
We've got to convince you. Is there anyone you'd want to talk to?
No.
I thought maybe. It's because she talks. Used to talk, like you at times. Maybe if I sent Miss Dagny Taggart to tell you?
That one? Sure she used to talk like me. She's my only failure. I thought she was the kind who belonged on my side, but she double-crossed me to keep her railroad. She'd sell her soul for her railroad. Send her in if you want me to slap her face.
No, no, no. You don't have to see her if that's how you feel. I don't want to waste more time on people who rub you the wrong way. Only if it's not Miss Taggart, I don't know whom to pick. If I could find somebody you'd be willing to consider, or...
I've changed my mind, said Galt. There is somebody I'd like to speak to.
Who? Cried Mr. Thompson eagerly.
Dr. Robert Stadler.
Mr. Thompson emitted a long whistle and shook his head apprehensively. That one is no friend of yours, he said in a tone of honest warning. "He's the one I want to see."
"Okay, if you wish.
If you say so. Anything you wish, I'll have him here tomorrow morning."